BCFM 93.2, your Bristol station.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show Friday Drive Time with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Filton's Tory MP Jack Lopresti has nothing to hide about his recent arms peddling trip to Saudi Arabia. Why did he change his story? And how secure is Bristol's food supply? If Britain managed to feed itself, well, just during the Second World War, with about 15 million more mouths to feed, could we do it now? Somerset farmer and the man behind Puxton Park, Derek Mead, is here to give farmer's eye view for us city dwellers. Plus, June's secret meeting of the NATO zone elite in Hertfordshire. We hear from a journalist that dared to ask a question or two at a previous get-together of the cartel of cartels, the Bilderberg Group. And Martin Summers takes us on his weekly tour of the world's hotspots. But first, the man who helped arms firm BAE Systems to close the airfield at Filton, Tory MP Jack Lopresti, has made an all-expenses trip to see the human rights abusing dictatorship, the royal family of Saudi Arabia, back in December, and he wasn't there to sell ice cream. So, why did he change his story? He wasn't there to see human rights groups, after all, but as a representative of the British arms industry. Could he be trying to make money from misery? We now talk to an expert on the evils of the international arms trade, former ANC MP in South Africa, an author of The Shadow World, Inside the Global Arms Trade, Andrew Feinstein. Hello, and welcome to Drive Time, Andrew.
Hi, good to be with you.
Great to hear you too. First of all, can you give us a little bit of background about these Saudi arms deals in the past, Andrew? The Al Yamamar, first of all.
Yeah, well, there's a long history of corrupt arms deals between Saudi Arabia and various countries, but predominantly the United Kingdom. And they've really run pretty much from the 60s with, first of all, the Al Yamamar deal, which you mentioned, which is probably the biggest arms deal in history to date, worth £43 billion. Now, in that particular deal, it was claimed by no less an authority than British police that around £6 billion of bribes were paid on that deal alone, including over £1 billion paid to the son of the then Saudi defense minister, who was also bought a birthday gift of an Airbus jet by BAE Systems, which was painted in the colors of his favorite American football team, the Dallas Cowboys. Now, there was an investigation for many years by the Serious Fraud Office into that deal. That investigation was closed down on the instructions of Tony Blair. So the allegations of this massive corruption, for which there is a huge amount of evidence, have never been properly investigated.
But Andrew, I mean, how can a Prime Minister actually just close down an investigation? Surely that's the job of the police to investigate and the judiciary to pursue justice.
Well, this is what makes the arms trade unique. There are these massive deals with very few people actually involved in them, and everything happens behind a veil of national security imposed secrecy. So Blair invoked national security as the reason for closing down the deal, because he said that the Saudis has threatened to stop intelligence cooperation with the UK unless the investigation was closed. In other words, the Saudis threatened the UK. The UK said, okay, we'll stop it. In fact, there was another reason, because intelligence wasn't the story. John Scarlett, who was head of MI6 around that time, said there was no national security reason to close down the deal. The real reason was that Tony Blair didn't want the massive corruption of the British state exposed. And it's because the arms companies have close relationships with political parties and politicians, and that they use those connections to invoke national security to hide what is in essence criminal behavior using taxpayers' money.
Well, that's a decade or more ago. In fact, several decades ago, the AMMR deal. What about SANCOM? What's that about?
Well, this is just to show, you know, anyone who thinks that this is something that happened historically. As recently as 2010, a deal was concluded between the Saudis and a British-based subsidiary of the defense conglomerate EADS to provide a warfare communication strategy system for part of the Saudi armed forces. This was a contract worth £2 billion. Now, a former lieutenant colonel in the British Army, Ian Foxley, was appointed project manager for the transaction, went off to Riyadh to take up his position, and found that basically nothing was happening in terms of actually delivering the contract. But what was happening is that a whole lot of money was being diverted to a number of offshore jurisdictions where it was going to companies that had basically done nothing on this deal. So it was another massive money laundering operation, diverting monies into the hands, probably as far as we can establish, of Saudi beneficiaries and quite possibly also European and British beneficiaries. And when Foxley returned to this country in a state of shock, having escaped from Riyadh, he took this information to the Serious Fraud Office and to the most senior politicians in the country. And it has taken over 2 years before the Serious Fraud Office agreed to launch an investigation into that particular case. But just a couple of weeks ago, the Exaro news agency reported that the SFO was planning to drop the investigation into that case. The SFO has denied this, but nobody's quite sure what the status of the investigation is now. So in other words, it's business as usual in terms of corrupt arms deals between Saudi Arabia and the United Kingdom.
Now, the Serious Fraud Office seems to have quite a lot to answer for at the moment, particularly with some of these massive city deals as well. I mean, the LIBOR scandal, no actual prosecutions, even though billions of pounds were stolen. We heard last week that the Treasury has a veto on whether or not it's going to fund Serious Fraud Office investigations. So, it really, ultimately, it seems, Andrew, it comes down to whether the Treasury wants to fund an investigation or not.
I don't think it's a matter of whether the Treasury wants to fund it, whether the Chancellor of the Exchequer wants to fund it. And given the nature of this government, given the nature of its economic policies, given the fact that almost everything it does favors the wealthy and corporations, that'll give you some clue as to the sorts of investigations that George Osborne wants to see funded and those investigations he wants to ensure are not funded. And believe you me, there is virtually no chance that there will be any investigation by British authorities of a major British company in relation to criminal activity and to money laundering. And it's a problem that's been going on in this country for decades. And if anything, as we speak today, it's getting even worse.
Your book, The Shadow World, Inside the Global Arms Trade, what has that taught you about the actual regime in Saudi Arabia? Because obviously if arms are being dealt to a despotic regime that is using them to do things like torturing, rounding people up, imprisoning at will, this kind of thing, then really, you know, it means that the British government, the British arms industry, is complicit in abuse of human rights and possibly war crimes.
Absolutely it is, and it's worth just mentioning that the United States is currently engaged in a $60 billion arms deal with the same Saudi regime. What it shows me is that the regulations that are in place, laws that are in place, arms export regimes that have been in place both at a national level and also at a multilateral level. So the UK should be conforming to the European Union's arms export common position, as well as the OECD position on anti-bribery and money laundering. But the reality is that when it comes to Saudi Arabia, the United Kingdom, along with many other governments, Germany and the United States being amongst the most obvious, are prepared to simply ignore that regulation, prepared to simply ignore the law, prepared to ignore their own arms export regulations in order to support what they see as a crucial friend in the Middle East. Because let's not forget that the Saudis are also involved in arming the Syrian rebels at the moment. The Saudis are propping up an equally autocratic and human rights abusing regime in Bahrain that is brutally putting down pro-democracy demonstrations and movements within that country. And it is all being done through Saudi Arabia. So Saudi Arabia is effectively the client of the nations of the West in the Middle East, as a consequence of which, despite the fact that for decades and decades, human rights organizations, including Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, have been documenting in terrifying and graphic detail the continuing human rights abuses of this completely autocratic regime, it has made no difference to the desire of the UK and other Western governments in selling that regime billions and billions of dollars of weaponry.
Now, most people know Jack Lopresti's name as an ice cream shop. Actually, he's got little ice cream vans that run around based in Bedminster here in South Bristol. But he then became the MP for Filton and Bradley Stoke and was instrumental in the what is effectively the close down and the sell-off of BAE Systems Airfield at Filton, which was where, you know, there were many... whole history of aviation there, and also a lot of aircraft companies still there, Rolls-Royce, GKN, Airbus, all still based at Filton, but now with no runway. And yet now he's Jack has been over to Saudi Arabia representing the British arms industry. What's your assessment of what his role might be in any kind of deal? I mean, we really can only guess, because he's saying that he was a representative of the British arms industry. So how do these sort of deals work?
Well, the reality is I don't know this particular case and the details of his specific trip to Saudi Arabia. But one of the crucial things to remember is that as I've covered these sorts of transactions across the globe, the one thing that really sticks in my mind is the role that individual politicians play in building the relationships that lead to these contracts, and sometimes in the very contracts themselves. We have the case historically, and I don't remember the exact year off the top of my head, but it's in the book, of a British politician, a Labour politician in that instance, who was also a junior minister, who got very involved in an arms deal with Saudi Arabia, was taking all sorts of money on the side, and landed up staging his own death. He supposedly drowned off the coast. I don't remember exactly where it was. He turned up years later living under a false identity in Australia and was eventually brought back to this country and faced charges of fraud. But it's extremely common. The role of individual politicians in these deals is absolutely crucial. So in the Al-Yamamah deal, Mark Thatcher, the son of the late Prime Minister, was paid £12 million on that deal. As far as I can establish, and as I've described in the book, his role seemed to be to act as something of a conduit between the arms dealers involved in that deal and his mother, the Prime Minister at the time. So the fact that an MP from an area of the country has a number of arms and aerospace companies in it is making visits to Saudi Arabia doesn't surprise me at all. But what it does do is raise some very serious red flags and leaves me extremely worried.
Well, Andrew Feinstein, author of the book, The Shadow World, Inside the Global Arms Trade, former ANC MP in South Africa, thanks very much for joining us on Drive Time this evening.
Thanks to talk to you.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
Now, Martin, we're going to go through some of the week's news stories. First of all, you mentioned very briefly last week the exiling of a film, Exile, A Myth Unearthed, on the BBC. This is the BBC 4 at the last minute dropping a film about the history and the myths of the history of the Jewish people and whether or not there really is any kind of right to return to the Holy Land.
Well, I mentioned it. I mean, it was scheduled to be shown, and I sat down to watch it to find that it had been pulled at the last minute. It's called Jerusalem, an Archaeological Mystery, I think.
Well, the BBC changed the title.
BBC changed the title.
His title was Exile, A Myth Unearthed, and they changed it to...
Yeah, well, they changed it to Jerusalem, an archaeological mystery or something, which he went along with in order for it to be shown. Is it the guy who made it is actually an Israeli, I believe.
Well, he's born in Israel. He's now living in New York.
Yeah. But I mean, basically, it's a historical documentary examining, you know, the history of the Jewish people, and, you know, and of course with modern genetic techniques, we've got a much better idea of where people travelled around the world and how they, you know, their various cultures were spread.
But I mean, this is quite a controversial film. What he's saying is that most, if not all, of the Jewish people that have returned to Israel since the Second World War, and some during the Second World War, of course, aren't actually from that part of the world. This is a pretty astounding
idea. In a sense, this is fairly obvious because most of the people who emigrated to Israel weren't born in Israel by definition. But I mean,
their families weren't. They have no connection.
As I understand it, what's happening in modern archaeology, and I haven't seen the film, so I'm just...
Well, no, nobody has. Nobody in Britain.
It looks like there's been a severe pressure put on the BBC to pull it, basically, presumably by the Israeli government and their supporters. I mean, essentially... What seems to be now, the archaeologists are now saying, is there's massive continuity of population. So in Cheddar Gorge, they found a skull 9,000 years old, about 15 years ago now, and they were really amazed when they found one local character, a history teacher, was related to this guy from 9,000 years ago. In actual fact, they've now found hundreds of people in Cheddar Gorge who are related to that chap, which shows that in actual fact populations don't change that much. You know, the people at the top change. Think of the Norman Conquest, they come in, but there's only a few thousand of them. They don't change the genetics of the population much, and it's what I think the controversial aspect of the film is, basically arguing that the original Jewish population converted to Islam and became the current Palestinians, and that fact, it sounds plausible to me, because that's usually what happens. The people who work the land don't get kicked off, they get, you know, new overlords, but they remain the same. They change their culture, they change their language often. I think in Britain the language changed to English, but the population was still essentially the Celtic population that had been there all along.
Well, we've had the Jewish right to return since the 1940s. What worries me is we may now have in the future the Palestinian right to return as well to the same land.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't argue too much about the genetics of this. I mean, basically, we've got to establish rules that everybody is entitled to go anywhere in the world within reason, but you can't just go in and take over a place and say it's ours and you can't have it anymore.
Well, talking about people going in and taking it over and saying it's not ours anymore, on Press TV, I love this little slot every week because we always have a little bit from Press TV, or most weeks, which is banned in Britain. It was banned by Ofcom, even though there are other channels that transmitted all sorts of nonsense about weapons of mass destruction in the run-up to the Iraq War. But they are still on the air. So Press TV this week had a look at a rather worrying situation at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is one of the holiest sites in the Islamic faith, in Jerusalem itself. And apparently the settlers, Israeli settlers and the Israeli army, are moving in on the mosque and actually excluding Muslims from it, even though it's one of their most holy spots. So let's have a listen to that little excerpt from that report from Press TV now that we're not allowed to hear in Britain.
The police evacuated all young Muslim worshippers in order to allow a group of 40 Israeli settlers to tour the compound. The next day, over 100 settlers gained access to the mosque, accompanied by Israeli forces. The Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock is the third holiest site in Islam. However, it is also a site where Jewish Israelis believe the Second Temple, a holy site for Jews, stood before Al-Aqsa. Following rigorous archaeological digs by the Israelis, they have found no proof of the existence of this site. Following the banning of Muslim worshippers from Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, Palestinian senior politicians have urged all Muslims to remain inside the compound in order to protect it from settlers and soldiers. They further state the Jewish are now trying to change the status quo by turning it into a Jewish place of worship.
Now, this is a real hotbed potentially, Martin, and I know in the past there's been battles over this between the Jewish population and the Islamic population in Jerusalem. Just give us a bit of historical context here over this site. Is it actually an Islamic site or a Christian site or a Jewish site?
It's all three, and that's of course the source of the problem. All three religions regard that particular site as holy to their faith. And of course, as a Muslim counsellor said to me last week, people have got to remember that the God that we are fighting over is the same one. Everybody agrees that.
But one thing
is
really...
the give and take, as I mentioned earlier, is quite a difficult thing for people to
accept. Well, there is this movement within Jerusalem and Israel generally, which says that this is the temple that they want to build, the third temple, the third of version of Solomon's temple on this very site, which is one of the holiest sites in Islam. Now, that's a bit of a worrying thing, because that is going to set those two faiths... Yeah,
but that,
essentially right against each
other.
Well,
I mean, as you saw in India, when the Hindu extremists burned down the Ayodhya mosque in Ayodhya because they said that it was on the site of their holy temple from years before. Now, these things could be settled by archaeologists, but actually the people aren't interested in finding out who really was in charge in the first place, and in a way it's irrelevant. People have got to make do. It's like in the sandpit, your toddlers have to learn to share their toys. And if we're all going to have, if all the three religions are going to have this holy mount as central to their religious beliefs, well, really they've got to share it, haven't they?
Bristol Community FM is a registered charity, which means we're not for profit, and we're now able to support local business by offering low-cost promotional announcements and adverts about your business or products. You can even sponsor a show, event, or outside broadcast. So why not support the station that supports the communities of Bristol? And contact us today to find out more. BCFM 93.2 FM. Bristol is our community.
Well, staying with the international news, and Martin. The Russians are selling these SAM S-300s to Syria. These are anti-aircraft missiles, presumably so that the Syrians can defend against Israeli air attacks, which we've seen a couple of in the last week.
Yeah, and I've also been seeing, I mean, obviously we're getting lots of information out of Syria, and everybody's trying to bend our perception of what's happening to suit their agendas. I mean, some stuff I've been reading suggests that Israeli artillery were responsible for those attacks. So they've actually got tanks inside Syria. I don't really know whether that's true, but everybody is basically telling fibs, and everybody's trying to...
But I mean, it's quite significant, isn't it, that the Israelis are now actually bombing Syria?
Well, I mean, as you see, the European Union and the Americans supported the Syrians in this action. The Russians and the Chinese and the Arab League opposed it. And, you know, the Israelis are playing with fire, getting involved in this business, because, of course, there was a split on the Syrian opposition side between those who welcomed the Israelis for bombing Syria and others saying that the Israelis should just keep out of it. But, I mean, basically, the situation we know is pretty bad for people over there. It's a fairly tragic situation.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
And also Adam Kokesh, he plans an armed march on Washington for the 4th of July for the American Independence Day celebrations. Now, a pretty controversial Iraqi war veteran he is. He's a radio host and a socially outspoken activist. But he's saying that they've got the right to do it under the American Constitution. They can have an armed march on Washington to celebrate Independence Day.
Well, it's provocative, isn't it? I mean, the Black Panthers used to shadow police officers in Los Angeles in the 1960s, and they would shadow them step by step carrying weaponry, which of course they were entitled to do under the Constitution. So they were basically doing one-to-one marking on the LAPD with guns. And of course you could argue that it was their right under the Constitution to do that, but of course it ended up with a lot of shootouts.
But isn't that the whole point of the American Constitution? They said, well, we didn't like the Brits because they only gave a certain elite the right to bear arms. We wanted to have everyone to have the right to bear arms, but then of course that could mean a massive shootout.
Well, the sad thing is that after the Sandy Hook massacre and the attempts to try to bring in some kind of gun control in the US, what's actually happened is people have gone out and bought more weaponry in the last few months than they bought in the last 5 years. And although it would be nice to imagine that all the Americans are going to give up their automatic weapons, the fact is they're not. Whether they're street gangs, Black Panthers, white powers people, or just people who want to defend their families against other people with guns. But you can see it's a pretty dangerous situation in the United States. You could see the United States turning into Colombia or Mexico quite easily if the economy went down the drain. And of course, if you've got no money but you've got a machine gun, you just go down to the supermarket and take what you want, and anybody can try and stop you, you'll shoot them. That's what happens in other parts of the world, not far away from the United States. I mean, 30,000, 40,000 people have been killed in Mexico in the last 2 years in drug-related violence. There's no reason why that can't happen in New York, Boston, and everywhere else if they're not careful.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
And finally, an Associated Press exclusive, which was in the Washington Post. Defence Secretary Chuck Hagel has demanded more information on Wednesday after the Air Force removed 17 launch officers from duty at nuclear missile base in North Dakota over what a commander called a rot in the force. Associated Press quoted from an internal internal email written by Lieutenant Colonel Jay Folds, Deputy Commander of the 91st Operations Group, which is responsible for all Minuteman III missile launch crews at Mino Air Base. He lamented the remarkably poor reviews they received in a March inspection. Their missile launch skills were rated marginal. The Air Force told the Associated Press was the equivalent of a D grade. We're in fact in a crisis right now, Folds wrote in the email to his subordinates. Tip-off to trouble was the March inspection that earned the equivalent of a D grade when the unit was tested in its mastery of the Minuteman III launch operations. And in April, the Air Force quietly removed these 17 officers. And this is the force that might launch a nuclear attack, Martin.
Well, I think we've come closer to nuclear war in the past than people realise. The Cuban Missile Crisis people have heard about, but in 1983 there was a mistaken identification of a missile, incoming missile launched by the Russians, and the guy who's been interviewed, who was in charge, he was sitting there on the day, it was his responsibility to press the button to fire back, and he said all of my bells were ringing red alert, and I made the judgment not to press the button. But in actual fact, we were terrified, this is a Russian guy, we were terrified of a first strike by the Americans, and we only really decided that they weren't going to first strike is because we had a spy at the top of NATO in Brussels, a German guy, who told us that they weren't in fact planning to attack us, but we were working on the presumption that Reagan and Thatcher were planning to attack us, and on that morning, we thought we were under attack, and it was only my decision not to press the button that stopped a nuclear war, and that's how close we are. And of course, don't forget, the Russians and the Americans are now squaring up over Syria, as you mentioned.
The email obtained by the Associated Press describes a culture of indifference at Mino Air Base, with at least one intentional violation of missile safety rules and an apparent unwillingness amongst some to challenge or report those who violate the rules. In addition to the 17, possible disciplinary action is pending against one other officer who investigators found had intentionally broken safety rules in an unspecified act that would compromise the secret codes that enable the launching of missiles that stand on high alert in underground silos in the US midsection. Folds are this is the officer involved, complained about unwarranted questioning of orders from superior officers by launch crews and failure to address superiors with the proper respect. It takes real leaders to lead through a crisis, and we are in fact in a crisis right now.
Well, it's worrying, isn't it? When it's like peeping underneath a curtain, and you can see something's going on, but what exactly?
I mean, they're saying
is,
unspecified. Somebody could maybe get their hands on these launch codes.
Well, I mean, Jonathan Pollard was a top US Navy chap, and he was eventually convicted of passing all of the US's nuclear secrets to the Israelis. He was paid by the Israelis. They then passed them on to the Soviet Union, as it then was, in return for various concessions on people leaving the Soviet Union to go and settle in Israel. So the whole of the US's nuclear program, the top stuff, was handed over to the Russians by the Israelis. Pollard is still in prison in the US. But I mean, nuclear weapons are dangerous. Don't we know that already? We should have realized it by now.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, in 2010, after being on the nation's council, a national council for 7 years, Somerset farmer Derek Mead made an audacious bid for the presidency of the National Farmers Union. It was, he said, the only way to stop the rot. So, hi Derek, and welcome to Drive Time.
Evening.
Now, why did you make a bid to take over the National Farmers Union?
I feel very strongly that it is essential that we farmers have a strong National Farmers Union. And at the moment, all we seem to get is presidents that are more concerned about knighthoods, non-executive directorships, maintaining supermarket margins, and then they are looking after the membership.
Well, now, that sounds immediately like a conflict of interest. If you're trying to maintain the margins of a supermarket, you're not really working in the interests of farmers.
No, well, it is, definitely. They and you've gradually seen over the years the demise of British agriculture, where we have a population now of some getting on towards 70 million people, and some people put the efficiency or the around about 70% that we need to import.
Okay, so we can't. Doesn't sound like we can feed ourselves. Anyway, let's start with talking a bit about your family history. Has your family been farming around Weston a long time?
For many generations, at least 6 generations, and we originate back to good serfs.
Serfs of whom?
Of the squire.
Okay, and what around what areas of Weston
just
that people might
rural,
know?
Weston-super-Mare.
Okay, take us through this debacle you had with the Farmers Union, because eventually you resigned, didn't you? Why did you decide to do that?
Basically,
was it sour grapes because you didn't win?
No, mainly because I got other business interests and I felt that I could do better by concentrating on them than actually staying within the NFU. The main problem in the NFU, the electoral system is democratic county-wise, but then when it moves on to regional and national, it's all on the nod.
How do you mean?
That they are told who they're going to vote for.
Sorry, told by whom?
By the presidency down through.
Oh, right, so it's a kind of a law of succession where the people, whoever's in charge, they've decided we're going to pick our successors. That's a bit feudal, isn't it?
Well, it's a disgrace. When it comes to county-wise, it's one member, one vote. And I was actually on the council for 9 years, and all through that period of time, they desperately tried to get me off as a delegate. But I'm very well known in Somerset, and they never succeeded.
Okay, one of your big bugbears was this relationship the NFU seems to have with the supermarkets. Have you got any evidence of that?
Well, if you take the president, which was about three times ago, Sir David Naish, he was president of the National Farmers Union, and he ended up as chairman of Express Dairies, which is one of the big dairy companies at that time, and it's reputed that when he retired, he got £1 million.
So, it sounds a little bit like politics, where politicians, say, for example, somebody who is involved in, say, privatising the health service might get a job in one of these private healthcare firms. So you're saying that the NFU is really no different to that?
Yep, perfectly. And the NFU have a subscription role and money they receive from the NFU Mutual. They'd have a role of about £20 million a year, which is at their disposal to spend. And, if I had £20 million to spend on the profile of British agriculture, I'd do a far better job.
Okay, what would you do differently than the current NFU are doing?
I think one of the main things, they've allowed DEFRA to actually who are totally inefficient. They never pass their audit. And they put on so much bureaucratic rubbish on the farmers, and then you've got Natural England on top of that.
No, just a minute, because bureaucratic rubbish, you call it, but I mean, this is maybe the stripping away of bureaucracy is one of the reasons why we've ended up eating horse meat.
Well, you're quite right. You know, one of the institutions that were produced by the previous Labour government was the Food Standards Agency, and it's absolutely ridiculous that they do not sample any product that is produced within Europe. They're only sampling produce that comes in from outside the EU.
But Derek,
and that is why you had trouble with the horse meat.
But Derek, you know, you've got to fess up here, put your hands up, because you must be getting a massive subsidy from Europe, from the Common Agricultural Policy, the CAP subsidies.
Everybody's very common. They really want to sort of have a go at farmers over subsidies. Now, we are members of the Common Market, or the EU. Right, now within the EU, you have the Common Agricultural Policy, which a lot of people seem to want to condemn, but the history of the Common Agricultural Policy is that many parts of Europe, after the last war, were starving. They were eating rats. And they brought the Common Agricultural Policy in to make sure that every member of the EU had plenty of food, which has worked very successfully. Now, it's all right calling wolf over the subsidies. Now there is plenty of food floating around. And now, really, it's been turned more into an environmental subsidy, where farmers get paid for set aside, get paid for growing their hedges and all the rest of the, I would call it rubbish, because farmers are there to farm. They aren't there to look after everything. And if you wanted to flip it on the other side, here we are now in 2013. The average working man is spending less on food than he ever has done.
Well, that's not true, because food prices are going up in the last year massively. I mean, many products are going up. You're talking about 15% increases in the amount of people are paying for their food. So, and of course, they are liable. I mean, they may blame the supermarkets, Derek, but they might also blame you.
Well, it's definitely not coming back to the farmers. When you've got farmers in the southwest, families on income supplements, and the only product that is got very dear is beef. And that is caused because the supermarkets were pulling in cheap beef from other parts of the world, which
and horse.
Yeah, well, that's the Food Standards Agency. You know, you really want to get onto the Food Standards Agency. Why weren't they sampling it?
With the current agricultural policy, wouldn't it make more sense if it favoured the smaller farmers? Because it does favour big farmers, doesn't it? I know the Queen and Prince Charles get massive amounts of money from the common agricultural policy, whereas actually they don't really need it. They've already got a massive income.
I wouldn't disagree. You know, I wouldn't disagree with you at all. I think that
is there any hope of that, though, Derek? Because I think that's one of the things we don't want the small farmers, do we? And smallholders, for example, going out of business. We want those to be thriving.
Quite agree.
And is there any prospect of that?
If you had a president of the National Farmers Union that was more in road with the family farm, you would more likely get that. But when you have a corn baron in there as a president, you haven't got a dog's chance.
Martin.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. I mean, I'm not against subsidies. You have to subsidise certain things, don't you? If we left the EU, we'd have to have some policy for agriculture. It wasn't just to get it all from New Zealand and Argentina. So this is what we have to do. I mean, McSharry, if you remember him, was head of the European Commission at once. He was an Irish guy.
Irish,
he was arguing in favour of, we've got to get the subsidy to the small farmers who we want to protect. But of course, what blocked that was the British veto of it. Because they were saying that we want a level playing field for our barley barons from East Anglia.
Yeah.
And I think the Welsh Farmers Union split from the National Farmers Union in the 1950s because they said, well, these English boys, they don't have our interests at heart. Mm. And they were right. Mm. And I think what people in the country, in the cities, for example, do see the need to subsidise agriculture, and I've spoken to French farmers, small farmers. They're saying what we want is a subsidy to be a farmer, and therefore then we can produce whatever you want. We give us, say, 10 grand a year to be a farmer, and that's our working capital, and off we go. And we should be subsidies per working farmer, not subsidies for what we produce, because then you end up with butter mountains and all the rest of it. But I mean, it's a sort of market that cries out to be properly regulated to get the right results that everybody wants. But the NFU, it sounds as if they're in the pocket of the big farmers and the supermarkets.
Right. I think if you looked at Europe, I think the French are the ones that are getting near enough where it should be. Yeah. And they got stricter laws on the power of supermarkets. They got the Galland law, which actually prescribes, say, in a certain area, a certain town, the size of the supermarket. And also that gives you the extra that you've got other people to deal with. You've got big, you know, smaller, you still keep your traditional butchers and your greengrocers and all the rest of it. But over here, our main problem is now, and whether it's gone too far to ever pull it back, where the latest figure I seen was about 87% of the food in this country is controlled by the supermarkets.
Yeah.
And that is so vast that you really got a job on to control it. And it's all right saying that food prices going up and up, but if you drive people out of business and a food gets short, prices will go up. And what you've got to create, and I think the French are getting as good as anybody, you've got to get a balance. You don't want too much power in the hands of the supermarkets, and you don't want too much power in the hands of the primary producers.
And in this country, the French farmers are often vilified as the main blockages to reform of the common agricultural policy. And of course, what people are often talking about, we don't have any subsidies at all for agriculture, let's just buy everything in from the US, for example.
Yeah.
I mean, I used to live in Poland, where they've got lots of very small farms.
Yeah.
And I was actually doing a PhD about the economics of it all. And they look very inefficient. They dig by hand. You know, if you've got a horse, you're a wealthy farmer, and a tractor is regarded as being seriously wealthy.
Yeah.
But in actual fact, if you look at their cost base, it's minuscule. If they get a few, $1,000 a year, they're happy.
Yeah.
And if they were allowed to compete straight, they'd win.
Yeah.
But of course, the illusion is that these kind of people are inefficient, and what we see in East Anglia is efficiency. But of course, what you see in East Anglia is a massive subsidised way of doing it with lots of chemical inputs and all the rest of it. And the Polish farmers could probably compete with that directly, but they weren't allowed to. The subsidy regime, they were given a limit how much they could have.
Yeah,
so in other words, they were thrown into the free market with the rest of the European community, but they weren't given the same subsidies as, say, the French or the British would get. And of course, that's just not fair.
But my main area is a dairy farm, right?
Yeah.
You know, we built 350 hosting cattle, yep. two herds. And our main problem is that I think is due to the inefficiency of ourselves to actually market milk properly. Mm-hmm. We need about 7.5 billion litres of fresh milk for the fresh market, which is getting on for about 2/3 of what we produce. And we sell that at half the value of water. Now, that is not good business. That is a disgrace. And it really makes you boil when you go along to the supermarkets and they want to use a marvellous product called milk as a loss leader.
Yeah.
And then you go into the services or the amount of sugary drinks and all the rest of it, which is very harmful to the population, obesity, bad for the teeth and all the rest of it. And when, and I expect you're one of them as well as me, were brought up on 1/3 of a pint at school,
yeah.
Which is a marvellous product.
Now, Derek, when back in 2010, after you'd been on the council for 7 years, you said the last straw came for you with the offer of a non-executive directorship with Dairy Crest to Richard MacDonald, the union's former director general. This is the National Farmers Union.
Yeah.
You said, I no longer wish to be associated with an organisation which now, it seems, exists merely as a stepping stone for officials and office holders into well-paid directorships rather than campaigning for British farmers. Now, you were also involved in something called Farmers for Action. Tell us about that.
Well, back in the early 2000, after, well, the history of the dairy industry is the demise of the milk marketing board in the mid-80s, we were receiving a price of milk for 25 to 28p, and then whether the government decided that they didn't want the milk marketing board any longer, and it was done away with, and then we ended up in chaos. And then we formed a thing called Milk Mark and the Dairy Trade Campaign with the Office of Fair Trading and got that split up and really opened the door for the dairy trade to actually murder us. And we could see milk prices dropping into the mid sort of teens, 15-16p, and a few of us got together and farmers were getting fed up all up and down the country, so we formed Farmers for Action, which went round blocking supermarket distribution depots and all the rest of it. And eventually they actually capitulated and moved the price back up by 2p.
So was that a victory, 2p?
It was a saving of the soul at the time. It helped to keep farmers in business. But that's not the solution of the problem. And the problem still is we're still divided and the trade rule. And they're ruling today. But you can see prices increasing now because we've been consistently losing about 3 dairy farms a week. And milk is getting very short, especially liquid milk.
Now, you're talking about dairy farms and milk a lot here. But what about the other sorts of farming? I mean, isn't that maybe what you're just representing your own interest, which is dairy? There's obviously other sorts of farming, for example.
Well, for example,
arable, you know.
Yeah, well... The arable boys have done pretty well, but they didn't have a very good year last year. They had a better price per ton of wheat, but their yields were down. But if you take the pig industry, which has been hit very hard, we had about 800,000 breeding sows in this country years ago, and now we're down to about 300,000. This is mainly because the supermarkets still want a little bit of security, but they mainly go to Europe where they can buy cheaper. And it's an absolute disgrace for the pig farmers because they've done away with crates, they've improved their husbandry, but they are competing with pork and bacon and that from other countries that haven't.
What about the idea of bringing in food substances, I mean, particularly pork is a good example, from abroad where the standards aren't as high as they are here in Britain? Does that happen?
Yes, it does, you know, and I read one report back along that your friends, the Food Standards Agency, are not sampling because it's produced within Europe, and they had 80% higher levels of antibiotics in it than they should have.
So there's an incentive, Martin, isn't there, really, for supermarkets to be importing a lot of food products because it's just simply cheaper. And particularly with livestock, that's important, that they're not being brought up properly. They're not being looked after.
You've got another big sore point coming up now recently because they changed the legislation over battery hens. And you've got to double the size of the pen. I don't know exactly because I'm not into chickens, but you've got to double the size of your, or not keep so many in a cage and all that sort of thing. But they have implemented it in Europe. So our poultry producers are going to be up against the wall. They spent millions and millions of pounds improving their husbandry, but will be competing with European, which haven't.
Well, the story you're telling me suggests that maybe you should be thinking about switching from being a livestock farmer, Derek, to doing arable. Is that feasible? Because it seems you've got a more guaranteed income like that.
Well, no. The Southwest is... it's all right where you've got free draining, nice soil, where you can grow corn. On the Somerset level land, which is a more of a heavy clay land, is not made for that job. You know, it is made to produce grass. And, you know, you've got a lot of history within the Southwest. You know, we produce some marvellous cheese called cheddar cheese, which we invented, comes from cheddar, and was produced off of grass, which made it really tasty.
So, no, you're not thinking about switching to arable?
We do some arable on ground that we got well drained, and we have got some grade one, grade two land, which we do use for corn.
And isn't it a fact that it actually is more, you need to employ more people to do arable farming than you do with the livestock, because you just send the livestock out to the field, they wander around, pretty much look after themselves.
Well, you better come and join me then.
Okay.
To get away with that myth.
Now, for many of us, city types like me, our experience of the countryside is sometimes good, sometimes bad. What are your thoughts about, because we've had a historic separation really between the urban population and the countryside population, in some ways typified by the country, and I think it's called Landowners and Business Association
which is
a lobby of its own.
Yeah.
And very, very separate. I mean, we live separate lives. The people in the cities don't really necessarily understand the needs of those in the country. Do you think that's actually partly your fault? Because many of the country people, they want to keep the city people off their land. Maybe keep them on a narrow little footpath somewhere.
No, I don't, because they got money in their pockets, you know, and money makes the world go round. And back when we had the very big outbreak of foot and mouth back in, I think it was 2002, Don Curry was instructed by the government. He did a report, and part of that report was to get more town people interested in the countryside so they knew exactly what's going on. And that's what inspired me and my family to actually create Puxton Park. Now, Puxton Park, you can go in there and have a good time, and you've got petting animals and all the rest of it, but also you can go and actually see the dairy cows being milked. And it's really encouraging when you've got children coming in there, and they come back again, because, you know, they thought Mr. Tesco was the milkman. He produced the milk. And they, you know, and a lot of them just didn't realise that it actually came from a cow, and through a milking parlour into a tank, and then it was pasteurised, and away it goes. And that's worked really well. And I think more of that should be done. And I think that's one of my criticisms of the National Farmers Union, that they are doing it to a certain extent, but we should be doing more.
But what about casual walkers? That's how I mostly experience the countryside, sometimes on the footpath, sometimes off the footpath. I mean, we see often, we have confrontations with farmers. Farmers will come drive, or maybe one of the farm workers will come and drive over. What are you doing here? This kind of thing. It doesn't really... there seems to be a bit of hostility, is what I'm saying,
in the
countryside for city people walking, wandering around.
I think it's all to do with education, really. I think... the general public want to educate him better, and really they got to realise that the farm is a factory floor. And your main problem, where there's been quite a bit of conflict, is when they got dogs with them, and you get cows and calves, and then the cows, they let the dog go, and the cow goes berserk, and the dog runs back to the person, and you've got a 10 hundredweight cow right behind it, which has done which is not very good for the person with the dog, and it's not very good for the image.
Now, you're talking about a factory floor. How seriously do you take wildlife, badgers, foxes and bird life? Because bird life, we hear, is in decline.
Well, the RSPB would like you to believe that. I think that they are doing a bad job. They are protecting certain species, which are eating the other species. And what we've all got to do is have a balanced countryside. And it's all right, you know, one of our main problems at the moment is the badger and the TB. And foxes, there's just hundreds of them, you know, and they are eating the ground nesting birds, which is where the decline is coming from.
What's your thoughts on the badger cull then, and the connections between TB? I mean, one of the things that comes up quite regularly is this idea that actually it's quite good for the cows to catch TB because they can build up some sort of immunity. The idea of if you're going to be blaming the badgers for it, it's only going to be another species that's going to start transmitting it.
You've hit the nail right on the head now, mate. My daughter's got a farm down in Devon. And she's just started up a herd of Red Devons, and she had 24, and within 9 months of her being there, over half of them went down with TB. They had legions, and so we've been monitoring it down there, and I've actually found a very, very mutated badger about a week ago, which I've taken down and had it tested, and it's riddled with TB. And people come up and say that it's not to do with a badger, but I think there's enough documentary evidence out there to actually pin it to the badger.
But my point is, if you just cull the badgers, there's other species that are going to transmit this disease.
Well, I think up to now, the main one that we find with the problem with TB is the badger. And I don't necessarily agree with the cull as it stands at the moment. And we've got a much better way that we think we can tackle this problem is by actually, we formed the Badger Welfare Association, because we don't think the RSPCA and Mr. May and all the rest of them are actually looking after the health of the badger. And we got a very excellent chap that studied the badger for many, many years, and we could actually identify the infected sets, and those are the ones we want to take out, and then you end up with healthy cattle and healthy badgers.
Oh, it sounds like definitely a good way forward. What's the difference, Derek, between the owner-occupying farmers and the tenant farmers? How are they both faring at the moment? Because there's obviously a big difference. If you own your own farm, you know, it's a little bit like if you're trying to run a factory and you don't even own it, you know, you're going to be up against it in these difficult economic times.
Your tenant farmers are particularly having a really hard time at the moment because the banks, if they've got any borrowings, will be at them because they haven't got the collateral of owning their land. And I think it's very serious, especially with last year being the wettest year on record, and some of the fellow Somerset farmers down in the Levels, you know, nearly didn't see their land for a year. And it's going to cause a lot of problems.
Okay, the ultimate question though, which is really one of the main reasons I asked you along today, can Britain feed itself in the current situation?
That is a very good question.
And Bristol particularly.
Well, yeah, big population. I think, first of all, DEFRA have got to change their attitude. And then you've got Natural England as well. For instance, the main problem with the Somerset Levels flooding, you know, there's a whole area of land there, never produced anything last year, because your Natural England want to increase water levels. The Environmental Agency don't really want to get stuck in and clean out the dikes and the reens properly. And if all these things are done, and you get more of a thrust to feed this country and assist with the balance of payments and a secure food supply, I think the production of food in this country could be increased considerably.
And
whether that will actually cover a total self-sufficiency in this country is debatable.
Any prospect of the end to the oligopoly of the supermarkets?
No, I don't think. When I was in the NFU, and it's all right blaming the supermarkets all the time, but we should be taking a leaf out the supermarket's book, and we should be advertising. And what we really wanted to do was produce a supermarket type magazine that actually identified where your farm shops are, or your regional foods come from, and all the rest of it. And I think that is the way forward to actually cope with the power of the supermarkets, because there is a lot, and I think it's growing, more and more people want to shop alternatively.
Okay, Derek Mead, Somerset Farmer, thank you very much for joining us.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
Well, it's the Bilderberg Conference, the second weekend in June. I spoke to US photographer and journalist and author of the book Solving 9/11, Chris Bolin, who came up against the Bilderberg security back in 2000 simply for doing his job, asking questions.
They came out for a breath of fresh air on this little lake, and they weren't really expecting to have very many journalists out there, and there weren't very many, you know. There was a lot of local people who wanted to see what was going on there. That was it. But I was clicking pictures of these guys that came out, and these are the heads, these are the former heads of the CIA and U.S. government and senators and what have you. And when I saw Carl Bildt come out with George Soros, I walked along with them, took some pictures, and I even ventured a question or two to Mr. Carl Bildt, because, you know, I know something about what's going on with him. And then there were some Belgian thugs, the security, so-called security for the Bilderberg Conference. Then they started following me and chasing me, and they forced me to retreat into a nearby restaurant, and then they waited outside, and I had to escape from that place and run to the train station and get on a train back to Brussels, because they use mafia tactics. They don't want people talking about them or photographing them. And that's the kind of, that's the game they're playing. It is a mafia.
Poor old Chris. Yes, a little bit thug-like. Anyway, time to sign off now. Up next is Cyrus the Virus, the typical topical Afro-tropical show. Thanks very much to the guest in the first hour, Peter Abraham, and also to Derek Mead you just heard there. I'm Tony Gosling. The website for this programme, thisweek.org.uk.
New national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.